Can I just check that these microphones are working all right? Yep. Okay. Plus the camera mic. Yeah, thank you. I feel like a spaceman. You know, this is the first time I've ever worn one of these incredibly fancy microphones. I do apologize for lecturing in English. I read German, but I'm afraid my German would be very incomprehensible if I were to speak it. So I have, at your places, I have asked to be distributed a little handout in which the key points that I'm going to make are set out. And I hope that will be of some help. I speak Irish English, so this may cause some problems to those who are used to standard BBC English. So, Judaism and the Christian mystical tradition. The debt of Christianity to Judaism is now widely acknowledged, not only by scholars, but by the educated public. It was not always so. There is a potent strand of Christian thought which sees true Christianity as lying in the negation of Judaism. Christianity may have originated historically in a Jewish milieu, and Jesus and the earliest disciples may have been ethnically Jews, but the gospel, so this position goes, only emerged in its full glory when the shackles of Judaism were thrown off and the church rejected the religion that had given it birth. The most extreme expression of this view was articulated in Gnosticism, which flourished in a myriad of forms in the Christian churches of the Mediterranean and Middle East in the second and third centuries. This cast the God of the Jews in the role of an ignorant and malicious creator of the world, the Demiurge, who stood in opposition to the good God who dwells in the realms beyond materiality, and who was revealed by Christ the Redeemer, who descended from that unseen divine realm to impart to benighted humanity the gnosis, the knowledge of how to escape from the present evil order. Orthodox Christianity strongly repudiated Gnosticism and offered a more balanced view of the relationship between the gospel and the law. The God of the Jews was the same as the God of the Christians, and the people of Israel had played a central role in God's purposes to bring in salvation to humankind. The most obvious expression of this view was the inclusion of the Jewish scriptures, the Tanakh, as the first part of the Old Testament, of the Christian Bible, fully acknowledged as Word of God. Negative attitudes towards Judaism did not go away. It remained standard in Christian theology right down to the present day to contrast the stern God of the Old Testament, implacably insisting on the implementation of the letter of the law, with the loving, forgiving, gracious God of the New Testament. But the ontological and ethical dualism of Gnosticism was gone. Instead, the history of the Sinai covenant and the whole history of the Jewish people was seen as a praeparatio evangelica, a preparation for the gospel, a necessary phase in the process of bringing in the full and final redemption in Christ. This view of the Old Testament as praeparatio evangelica has profoundly shaped not only Christian theology, but Christian historical scholarship as well. It has generated the whole debate over the parting of the ways, the search for the point in time when the church finally emerged from its Jewish cocoon and took flight as the new liberated universal people of God. The standard Christian view was that this happened early. The formation of the universal church as the new Israel, it was argued, was to be found in the teaching of Jesus himself, at least implicitly, if not explicitly. Christians, interestingly, tended to put the blame for the separation of the church from the synagogue on the Jews. It was they who banned the Christians from their synagogues and who made it difficult for those who followed Christ to remain even socially part of their communities. It was they who denounced the Christians to the Roman authorities as not true Jews, and so not entitled to Roman protection as a legal religion, a religio licita, which resulted in the martyrdom of many pious Christians. Christian scholarship focused particularly on a synod which was supposedly convened at Jamnia, or Yavne, in the 70s of the first century to attempt the reconstruction of Jewish religious life following the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 of the current era. This synod was seen as taking measures to ensure the separation of Jews from Christians, including the introduction of a benediction into the standard Hebrew prayer, the Amidah or 18 benedictions cursing the Christians. Now, interestingly, Judaism traditionally was happy to acquiesce in this theological and historical construction, because it too wanted a parting of the ways, and the earlier the better. Judaism, after the destruction of the temple in 70, came to be dominated by the rabbinic movement, and one of the major aims of that movement over centuries was to maintain the separation between Jews and Christians, to uphold the separate identity of Judaism in the face of the theological, cultural, and even legal onslaught of an increasingly triumphant Gentile Christianity. A curious example of this Jewish point of view is found in some forms of the Toldot Yeshu, the generations of Jesus, a Jewish anti-gospel which has been popular in Judaism down to the present day. This attributes the separation between the church and the synagogue as having been engineered by Simon Peter. Yes, Simon Peter, the disciple of Jesus, who according to tradition became the first bishop of the Church of Rome. Simon Peter, claims the Toldot, was actually an undercover agent of the Jewish sages, who insinuated his way into the leadership of the Christian church and then persuaded the Christians that because Jesus had rejected the law, they should do the same and so part company with the Jews. There is something mischievous, and I must confess I find rather funny, in this sowing of the seeds of doubt in Christian minds about the authenticity of so revered a figure of Christianity as Peter the first pope. But in the story, Peter gets something of a payback. Having persuaded the Christians to break with Judaism, he was then stuck. If he went back and joined the rabbis who had sent him, he would give the game away, and his work would be undone, so he had to keep up the pretense. His solution was to have the Christians build him a tower in Rome, in which he lived in isolation secretly as a Jew, corresponding with the sages. And at his death, this tower became his tomb. The reference here is probably to the oratory raised over Peter's supposed tomb in Rome, which was a site of Christian pilgrimage. In the 4th century, it was buried under Constantine's Basilica, which suggests this Jewish tradition originated before 300. So my basic point is, both sides, the Christian and the Jewish rabbinic, conspired to force the separation of the ways. And the understanding was that this happened early in history. Classically, on the Christian side, it was seen as happening in the first century of the current era. The early parting of the ways theory has had a profound influence on the historiography of both Judaism and Christianity. It has generated the widely shared assumption that once Christianity and Judaism separated, the deep mutual hostility that developed ensured that there was no significant exchange of ideas or practices or traditions between the two sides. It was taken for granted, for example, that in the case of elements such as the Sanctus, the Holy, 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 widespread in Christian rites of all traditions, an element which has long been recognized as bearing striking resemblance to the synagogue Kiddushot, must have been borrowed from Christianity, by Christianity from Judaism, before the parting of the ways, and therefore be very early. I shall return to this in a moment. In recent decades, this view has been strongly challenged, and a consensus has emerged that, in fact, the two traditions interacted long after the common first century date of the parting of the ways, and in fact have never ceased to do so down to our own time. The dramatic turn was perhaps most clearly manifested in the collaborative research project set up by Oxford and Princeton universities in 2001-2002 to explore the question, the fruits of which were published in 203 under the title The Ways That Never Parted. Peter Schaefer, now director of the Jewish Museum in Berlin, was a prime mover in that project, and he forcefully expressed his own views in a series of lectures given some years later at the University of Jena, which were published in German under the title Die Geburt des Judentums aus dem Geist des Christentums, and less provocatively in English as The Jewish Jesus, How Christianity and Judaism Shaped Each Other. Now, there's a danger that the pendulum is swinging too far the other way, and that we're forgetting the simple fact that from the second century CE, Judaism and Christianity have been theologically, institutionally, liturgically, socially, politically, and legally different religions. The extent to which this turn towards the idea of the ways that never parted marks a radical paradigm shift can be overstated. In some ways, it can be seen as revamping the much earlier concept of a Judeo-Christian tradition, and the possibility that there may be deep theological assumptions at play in this turn, this intellectual turn, here remains troublingly unexamined. But the basic point seems well made, namely that it can be no longer simply assumed that from the second century CE onwards, Judaism and Christianity went their separate ways and only interacted with one another in terms of polemic and persecution. One manifestation of the continuing interaction of the two traditions, which I find particularly compelling, is the discovery that there appears to be an ongoing, intense dialectic between Jewish and Christian interpretations of their shared scriptures in late antiquity, the Middle Ages, and modern times. Study after study has argued convincingly that the classic rabbinic Bible exegesis of the Talmudic period, embodied in the Midrashim, has been significantly shaped by Christian Bible interpretation. This fact has been largely concealed by the remarkable absence of explicit reference to Christianity in the Jewish texts. But close reading of them, intertextually with patristic Bible commentary, shows clearly that there is a debate going on, and that the lack of express reference on the part of the rabbis to Christianity as what we call in English a loud silence, designed to deny Christianity the oxygen of publicity. It is in the context of this new insight into the ongoing and intense dialogue between Judaism and Christianity that I want to explore briefly the relationship between the Jewish and the Christian mystical traditions. What I will attempt to show is that the kind of interaction that has been discovered in other areas can be found there too. The influences are mutual. Judaism, having profoundly influenced the origins of Christian mysticism, was in turn profoundly influenced in its mystical ideas by Christian mysticism. Though mysticism may be something of a special case, in that it may, by its very nature, be particularly open to outside influences, and for this reason quite often gets labeled as heretical within its own traditions. The findings there are broadly in line with what others have discovered in other areas. But first, I need to be clear what I mean by mysticism. I can hear you groan, but this is very important. What do we mean by mysticism? This has been one of the most contentious terms in the study of religion. No one can agree on its definition, and for that reason, some would banish it from discussion as useless for any descriptive or analytical purposes. This is going too far and involves a bit of confused thinking. Mysticism is a modern scholarly construct, a tool for categorizing and analyzing a large and amorphous body of texts and traditions. Basically, we decide on our definition, with reference, of course, to texts and phenomena that would be generally accepted as mystical. The fact that our definition perhaps is nowhere clearly expressed by the mystics themselves does not invalidate it. In fact, it is neither here nor there. As scholars in the academy, we have to forge our own tools which allow us to understand this important religious phenomenon in academic terms. This means translating the ideas of the mystics into terms which we as academics can understand. It means fundamentally translating from muthos, which is the characteristic discourse of mysticism, to logos. The default mode of discourse of the academy, of the university, though some forms of contemplative mysticism, what is sometimes called mystical theology, already come close to logos and tend consequently to bulk very large in academic studies of mysticism. The translation has to be carefully done, but there is no alternative. Now let me try very quickly. I don't want to get sidetracked into methodology, but let me try very quickly to give you my definition of mysticism. My definition of mysticism starts from a widespread, though perhaps not universal, human experience, the sense of what I call transcendent presence. This is the sense that beyond the material world of the senses lies an ultimate reality, which constitutes in some way the ground of the world we know. In Judaism and Christianity, that ultimate ground of being is called God, and this is the term I shall use for it from now on. The second element of mysticism is the consuming desire that affects some of those who sense the presence of this transcendent reality to enter into relationship with it. They feel drawn inexorably towards it. They long to experience union or communion with God. In traditional studies of mysticism, this is called the unio mystica. In some cases, it seems to involve the annihilation of the self, its total absorption into the greater being of God, like a drop of rain falling into the ocean. This idea is problematic in strict theistic terms because theism is predicated on a fundamental ontological gap between the underived being of God and the contingent being of his creatures, a gap which cannot be crossed. In other forms of mysticism, the gap is not crossed. What we have is not union but communion with God, the soul's eternal contemplation of the beatific vision. The third element is what is often called the via mystica. This denotes the means by which the unio mystica can be achieved, and they can run from magical techniques, on the one hand, to intellectual contemplation of the nature of God on the other. All the classic mystical systems see the Via Mystica as long and difficult. It is an itinerary, a pilgrimage into God. It requires long spiritual discipline, and classically it involves times when the mystic loses the sense of the divine presence, or even feels that God has turned against him and wants to destroy him, a condition sometimes referred to in the mystical manuals as the dark night of the soul. The Via Mystica is therefore sharply differentiated from the instant highs induced by taking drugs, though the use of stimulants is by no means unknown in mystical praxis. Two further points are worth making about mysticism before we proceed. First, it is fundamental to mysticism that God cannot be grasped by the intellect nor caught in human speech. The mystery of God is ineffable. That does not mean that he is unknowable. Intellect may play a part in the search for union with God in contemplative mysticism, but it is limited in what it can achieve, and other faculties of the soul, such as imagination, have a major role to play. Apophaticism, that is to say, the inexpressibility of God, is not the same even functionally as atheism, despite the claim of Cleanthes in David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. It's a wonderful passage in David Hume's Dialogues, the Scottish philosopher, Enlightenment philosopher, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, in which one of the people, Cleanthes is the name given to him, argues that atheism and the unknowability of God are functionally the same. That is a total misunderstanding. The sense of God's presence once achieved is sensed as immediate, and metaphors drawn from the senses, tasting, seeing, thirsting, are often used to describe it. The idea of ineffability of God plays itself out in the style of many mystical writings. They are quite deliberately difficult, paradoxical, contradictory, and rely heavily on cloudy, multivalent symbols. The last thing they are seeking for is propositional clarity. Second, the interplay between experience and literary artifice in the mystical literature is complex and often misunderstood. I have put experience at the heart of my description of mysticism, but experience has to be interpreted before it can be internalized and communicated to others. And how that is done is determined by the culture to which the mystic belongs. It has often been noted that, historically speaking, there is no mysticism per se. Mystical traditions are embedded in broader religious traditions and borrow from their belief systems and language to make sense of the raw experience. So we have Jewish mysticism, Christian mysticism, Islamic mysticism. It is only in the 19th century that attempts were made to distill from these separate strands a mystical essence and set it up as a perennial universal religious philosophy. The interpretation and communication of the core religious experiences has created a vast mystical literature in which the core experiences can sometimes be barely discerned. The literary tradition develops its own literary momentum and dynamic, with one text being taken up in a literary way by another. This is what forms the basis of the great histories of mysticism. Historians of mysticism too often forget that what they are dealing with is basically literature and literary artifice, which stands in a very problematic relationship to the underlying experience. It is surprising, for example, how many simply assume that Hildegard of Bingen, the great medieval German mystic of the 12th century, her Scivias, her most famous work, contains a direct, accurate transcription, complete with beautiful diagrams, of her mystical visions. I think not. It's a highly literary work. On the other hand, we must avoid the opposite trap of assuming there is really no experience behind the literary tradition. It is all literary artifice. The temptation to assume this is strong. The Academy has ways of dealing with literature and with propositions, but it handles religious experience very badly and often shies away from it. This is why I would argue the historians of mysticism in both Judaism and Christianity, the histories of mysticism in both Judaism and Christianity, are so heavily skewed towards the literary and contemplative slash propositional aspects of the tradition to the neglect of the experiential. Academics do not handle comfortably religious experience. I'll return to this point in a moment. Now, I've spent a considerable time in preliminaries because they're absolutely necessary to make any sense of what follows. Both Judaism and Christianity have a large body of literature which conforms broadly to the definition of mysticism which I have just advanced. For present purposes, we may take Gershom Scholem's Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism as an authoritative map of mysticism on the Jewish side, and Bernard McGinn's massive 7-volume history of Christian mysticism, published under the general title of The Presence of God, as an authoritative map on the Christian side. One feature about these great works is how little they reference each other's traditions. This is particularly true of Scholem's Major Trends, which takes a strongly genealogical view of the Jewish mystical tradition, by which I mean that Scholem sees it very much in terms of a genealogy of mystical texts, each generation of texts building on an earlier generation in a way that is remarkably insulated from the surrounding world. Having defined the earliest phase of Jewish mysticism, the so-called Hechalot, or Heavenly Temples mysticism, as a form of the Gnosticism that was widespread in the Greco-Roman world, he then saw this Jewish Gnosticism as subsequently passed down, largely unaffected by outside influences, through the medium of literary texts, including the mysterious work known as Raza Rabba, which is no longer extant, but by which Scholem set great store. He largely ignored the fact that later instances of the flowering of Gnosticism within Judaism sometimes took place in contexts where Gnosticism was flourishing in the surrounding culture. Equally, there are few references to the Jewish mystical tradition in McGinn's massive history, apart from an important opening chapter to which I will return in a moment. Reading the two histories side by side, one might be forgiven for drawing the conclusion that the two mystical traditions ran on parallel tracks and never at any point converged. However, research has been accumulating over the past few decades, which strongly suggests that this was not the case. There are numerous moments in history when it seems the two traditions did significantly interact. Among these are, one, the first few centuries of the current era, when there are good grounds for thinking Christian mysticism grew out of Jewish mysticism. Two, the Middle Ages on Provence and Spain, where Christian influence on such major Jewish mystical texts as the Bahir and the Zohar is now convincingly documented. Three, the Middle Ages in the Rhineland, where parallels between the mystical ideas of the Rhineland school of Jewish mysticism, known as the Pious of Germany, the Hasidei Ashkenaz, and Rhineland Christian spirituality, represented by Hildegard of Bingen and others, now seems clear. Four, at the Renaissance, when a Christian school of Kabbalism flourished, directly based on the great medieval Jewish mystical texts, such as the Zohar, the Bahir, and the writings of Avraham Abulafia. Five, in modern Hasidism, described by Gershom Scholem as the last phase of Jewish mysticism from the 18th century onwards to the present day. There are intriguing parallels between the mystical praxis of the founders of Hasidism, such as Israel Baal Shem Tov, the Besht, and Eastern Christian Orthodox spirituality of the 18th century. The parallelism between the more contemplative philosophical traditions of Chabad, Lubavitch Hasidism, represented, for example, by the Tanya, or by the writings of the late Lubavitcher Rebbe on the one hand, and Christian mystical theology on the other, have barely been explored. But such exploration as has been done suggests the parallelism is significant. Apart from the period of the origins and the Renaissance, the direction of influence seems mainly to be from Christianity to Judaism. But we need to be careful. Influences the other way, or mutual influences, are seldom seriously considered, because historians have tended to work with an assumption about Jewish-Christian relations down through history that render such mutual influence virtually unthinkable. Were Jews likely to borrow from their hated Christian persecutors? Or Christians likely to borrow from despised Christ-killing Jews? Such stereotyping will no longer do. It has been shown by historians time and again that Jews and Christians have interacted socially and intellectually down through the ages despite the mutual hostility between them. And it should be remembered that McGinn traces the history of Western Christian mysticism. His history, like most histories of the church, moves steadily westwards into the Latin-speaking medieval world where his expertise lies. He says little, consequently, about Eastern Christian mysticism, apart from the classic patristic period, and next to nothing about mysticism in the great Syriac-speaking church of the East. There is evidence, I would argue, of strong and continuous Jewish influence, particularly on Syriac Christian mysticism. Nor should we forget the role that may have been played by Jewish converts to Christianity in the development of Western mysticism. McGinn considers Simon Weil, 1900 to 1943, a Christian mystic. But of course she was Jewish, born into an intellectually distinguished Jewish family. She later became fascinated by Christianity, in particular by Catholicism. But she could never bring herself to cut the umbilical cord with Judaism and was never baptized. The extent to which her Jewish formation and Jewish knowledge shaped her mystical encounters with Christ is an obvious question to pursue. Similarly, it is now clear that Teresa of Avila, 1515 to 1582, a towering figure of Christian mysticism, was of Marano, that is Jewish convert, descent, and was aware of it. There have been a number of tantalizing studies which have alleged that Jewish influences can be detected in her mystical writings. The case is not entirely convincing. Nevertheless, she serves to point up the possibility of Jewish influence on Spanish Christian mysticism. In the time that remains to me, I cannot cover all the possible moments of potential interaction between the Jewish and Christian mystical traditions that I listed earlier, so I will confine myself to three: the origins of Christian mysticism, Jewish mysticism in Provence in the early Middle Ages, with particular reference to the Book of Bahir, and Christian Kabbalism at the time of the Renaissance, with particular reference to the writings of Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. The first of these I will try to cover in some depth because it's the least known and to me the most interesting. The other two, which have been covered more thoroughly by others, will be treated more sketchily. So, the origins of Christian mysticism. What are the origins of Christian mysticism? My good friend Andrew Louth, in his influential monograph, The Origins of the Christian Mystical Tradition, has no doubt. The founding father of Christian mysticism is Plato. This is clearly signaled in the subtitle of his book, From Plato to Dennis. Judaism is nowhere mentioned. The Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria does get a chapter, but he qualifies because he is a Platonist and not because there's anything Jewish about him. Bernard McGinn, by way of contrast, traces the origins of Christian mysticism back to Second Temple Judaism. It was then that the matrix, his word, was formed out of which Christian mysticism was later born. Who is right? Both are, in a way, though I would argue McGinn is more right than Louth. Tracing the origins of Christian mysticism is like tracing the origins of a mighty river. The headwaters of great rivers consist of a myriad of streams which finally converge to form the main channel. Which of these streams constitutes the source of the river? Geographers use different criteria, sometimes choosing the longest stream, sometimes the one with the greatest flow. I would argue that certainly on the latter count, McGinn is right. Second Temple Judaism provides the largest and earliest input into the Christian mystical tradition. The Platonic stream only joins it in the 3rd century CE at the earliest, and in ways that show that it is supplementary to the main channel. McGinn finds the headwaters of Christian mysticism in Second Temple Jewish apocalyptic, with its frequent visions and ascents to heaven, which he sees as foreshadowing the doctrine of the ascent of the soul. Now, there are undoubtedly some suggestive anticipations here, at least at the descriptive level, and later mystical texts have a component which draws on the language and imagery of these apocalypses to describe the mystic's visionary experiences. In Christianity, the key text here is the Book of Revelation, a work deeply indebted to Second Temple Jewish apocalyptic. In Judaism, it's the Book of Daniel and the earlier prophetic texts of Isaiah and Ezekiel. But there are problems with seeing Second Temple Jewish apocalyptic as mystical. The roots of apocalypticism lie in biblical prophecy, and the purpose of the vision in apocalyptic, as in earlier prophecy, is to commission the writer, or rather his pseudepigraphic persona, Enoch or whoever, as a true revealer of secrets. The purpose of an apocalypse is to reveal secrets, to impart knowledge, either about the future or about the cosmos, not as in mysticism, to describe an intense moment of communion with God or to show anyone else how to achieve this communion. And scholars of apocalyptic disagree strongly on how much experience lies behind the texts. Though the experiential roots of apocalyptic have, in my view, been seriously underestimated, there can be no denying that the texts as they stand contain massive amounts of literary artifice. I do not want to deny that there is a link between Second Temple Jewish apocalypticism and later mysticism, nor that from time to time later mystical texts shade into apocalyptic. Here I would mention once again the Scivias of Hildegard of Bingen, with their strong didacticism, which strikes me as much more apocalyptic than mystical. But there is one Second Temple Jewish text which McGinn failed to notice, which I would argue is genuinely mystical, and indeed appears to be the earliest documented text that so far we have discovered in the Western mystical tradition. It is found among the Dead Sea Scrolls and is known as the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. The text is fragmentary, but a sufficient number of copies of it survive for us to piece it together with considerable certainty. It describes a liturgy, performed by the community at Qumran over a period of 13 Sabbaths, in which they enter successively into the various courts of the celestial temple, till finally they find themselves in the innermost shrine, where they achieve the beatific vision of God and join the highest angels in silent adoration of the divine mystery. Behind this liturgy lies the old idea that corresponding to the earthly temple is a heavenly temple in which God dwells and where the angels offer him the offering of the lips, the offering of praise. The paradigm for this picture is Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah sees the seraphim chanting the Sanctus around the throne of God in the heavenly temple. Only in songs of the Sabbath sacrifice, the earthly community joins with the angels. They perform a liturgical ascent, an ascensio liturgica. And it is this crucial element that turns this text from being apocalyptic into being mysticism. The idea first foreshadowed in Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice from Qumran have had a vigorous afterlife in both Judaism and Christianity and fed powerfully into their respective mystical traditions. I cannot here go into all the detailed analysis that would be necessary to prove this claim historically. I have laid out some of it in my book on the mystical texts among the Dead Sea Scrolls. A few notes will have to suffice here. In Judaism, that afterlife can be seen in the synagogue liturgy, in the elaborate liturgical structures known as kiddushot, such as the kiddushah found in the benediction Yotzer Or, which precedes the morning recital of the Shema. These have precisely the same function as the songs, to unite the worshipping community on earth with the worshipping community in heaven. And the mode of ascent is the same. The worshipper visualizes through an elaborate description, an ekphrasis, to borrow a Greek term, employing highly charged emotive language, the angels performing the heavenly liturgy, and so comes to feel at one with them. But the afterlife of this idea can also be detected in Jewish mystical literature, particularly in the so-called Heichalot, heavenly temple texts, which Scholem saw as the beginnings of the genealogy of Jewish mystical literature. Turning to the Christian tradition, we can trace a similar two-pronged reception in liturgy and in mystical literature. The Sanctus, the Christian equivalent of the Kiddushah, has been, at least from the 3rd century, an integral element of the liturgy of the Church in all branches of Christendom. And the purpose here, too, is clearly to unite the worshippers on earth with the worshippers in heaven. In my own Anglican tradition, the Sanctus occurs most memorably in the preface to the Eucharist, the president having noted that it is the congregation's bounden duty, I'm quoting the old version of the prayer book here, to praise God, continues, "Therefore with angels and archangels and with all the company of heaven we laud and magnify thy glorious name, evermore praising thee and saying," and here traditionally the congregation joins in, "Holy, holy, holy Lord of hosts, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. Glory be to thee, O Lord Most High." It is very hard, if you're attending a service where this liturgy is performed, not to feel a quickening of the liturgical tempo at this point, as the veil between this and the other world suddenly becomes thin and the worshippers on earth become aware of the parallel liturgy of the angels in heaven. The form of the Sanctus in the Anglican Rite and in many Western Rites, is quite minimal. But in Syriac liturgy, we find the kind of elaborate ekphrasis which marks the synagogue kiddushot, an attempt through elaborate description to compel the worshipper's imagination, to picture the heavenly scene. We find also the afterlife of the idea in Christian mystical literature. And here I would mention two key texts. Gregory of Nyssa's Life of Moses, in which Moses' ascent to Sinai to receive the law is taken as a paradigm of mystical ascent. The relationship of this text to the Jewish mystical tradition in general and the songs of Sabbath sacrifice in particular has been explored by my former student, Anne Conway Jones, in her recent monograph, Gregory of Nyssa's Tabernacle Inner Imagery in its Jewish and Christian Contexts. One thing which I think her analysis shows, though it is not a point which she herself stresses, is how the Platonic strand is so neatly integrated into the Jewish strand of Christian mysticism in Gregory, but in a subsidiary way. It is the Jewish strand that provides the basic narrative. The second text I will mention is the Celestial Hierarchies of Dionysius the Areopagite, the father of the Western Christian mystical tradition. I have explored elsewhere the relationship between Dennis and the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. These two texts are separated by around 600 years and belong to very different religious communities. And I am not for one moment suggesting that Dennis had a copy of the songs, but the parallelism is uncanny and suggests that both the songs and the celestial hierarchies belong to the same mystical tradition and lie on the same mystical trajectory. Dennis's Platonism is even more pronounced than Gregory's, and his indebtedness to the Neoplatonic philosopher Proclus is well documented. But again, I would argue that this Platonism is used to clarify and embellish a fundamentally Jewish narrative. Before I pass on, I need to make one observation. And it is that the importance of liturgy has been catastrophically underestimated in histories of both Jewish and Christian mysticism. In history after history, by eminent and learned scholars, it barely gets a mention. The default mysticism of the histories is the history of mystical ideas expressed in mystical literature, and by and large, it concerns the experience of great lone individual mystics. This is certainly the starting point of Scholem's major trends. But the primary locus of mysticism in both traditions is arguably the liturgy. And it is in the performance of this that most Jews and Christians experience the elevation of the soul and the altered states of consciousness which lie at the heart of the mystical experience. And ascent is normally communal and not exclusively individual. The centrality of liturgy is actually acknowledged by many of the great classical Jewish and Christian mystical writers. It is fundamental to the praxis of mysticism in Dennis, and it is fundamental to the praxis of mysticism, for example, in the hugely influential Safed school of Jewish mystics in the 16th century. We must beware of the elitism in our histories of mysticism and of concentrating on the great mystics and the great texts of the contemplative tradition simply because these are what we can most easily cope with sitting in our academic ivory towers. I come quickly and much more briefly to the two other moments I mentioned of interaction between the Jewish and the Christian mystical traditions. First, to Provence in the early Middle Ages, the 12th century to be exact, and to the text usually seen as the founding manifesto of medieval Kabbalah, the Book of Bahir. One of the most striking aspects of this mysterious work is the role it assigns to the feminine principle in the Godhead, the Shekhinah. Now, the Shekhinah is an old concept in Jewish theology. It designated the indwelling or presence of God in the world, the sense of which is seen as the greatest happiness a human can enjoy. It is a deeply mystical concept. The Shekhinah and the Bahir is the tenth, the lowest of the 10 emanations or attributes through which the unknowable God makes himself known to the world. It mediates between the Godhead and the world, and in keeping with its grammatically feminine gender in Hebrew, it is given female attributes. Now, this is new. Where did the idea come from? Gershom Scholem, in keeping with his strongly genealogical approach to the history of Jewish mysticism, argues that the core of the Bahir goes back to an old Jewish Gnostic text handed down from antiquity. He does consider the possibility that contemporary ideas may have played a part, but what he looks at is the Catharism, which was flourishing in Provence at the time, the Albigensian Crusade in which the Catholic forces crushed the Cathars ran from 1209 to 1229, just after the appearance of the Bahir. He finds no significant correlation between the Bahir and Catharism, despite the fact that both are, in his terms, Gnostic. And this reinforces his view that the Bahir is relying on ancient esoteric doctrines passed down from antiquity within Jewish circles. What he did not look at, however, was contemporary Catholicism. And this is precisely where Peter Schaeffer looked. Schaeffer argues in Mirror of His Beauty, Feminine Images of God from the Bible to the Early Kabbalah, that there is a sufficient correlation between the doctrine of the Shekhinah in the Bahir and contemporary Christian ideas of the enhanced heavenly status of the Virgin Mary and her role as a mediatrix between heaven and earth to suggest the possibility of Christian influence on the Jewish text. This thesis has generated heated scholarly debate, but Schaeffer has convinced me that he is on the right lines. I would be tempted to complicate the picture by seeing the Christian definition of the exalted status of Mary as drawing in part on ancient ideas about divine wisdom, Sophia in Greek, Chochmah in Hebrew, both feminine nouns, which are ultimately Jewish in origin. The Shekhinah had already been compared to wisdom in earlier Jewish thought, so the gap between Mary as heavenly mediatrix and the Shekhinah was not all that hard to bridge. Fast forward now, if you will, nearly 300 years to meet a brilliant young Italian nobleman studying in the Academy of Marsilio Ficino in Florence, the cradle of Italian humanist thought. His name was Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, and he was to become one of the most important thinkers of the Renaissance. The most obvious influence on Pico, not surprisingly giving the leanings of Ficino, was the Platonic tradition. But he was a born eclectic and combined with Platonism ideas derived from many other diverse sources, Hermeticism, even Aristotelianism, and Jewish mysticism. He seemed to have felt that there was one underlying truth or philosophy in all the great intellectual traditions received from the past, and he set out to distill it into his own philosophy. His encounter with Jewish mystical literature, specifically the Kabbalah, was profound and extensive, and he was the first to disseminate Kabbalah beyond Jewish circles. The story has been well told by Chaim Verzhubsky in his classic 1989 monograph, Pico della Mirandola's Encounter with Jewish Mysticism. Pico commissioned a converted Jew from Sicily, Guglielmo Raimundo Monsada, who used the pen name Flavius Mithridates, to produce a Bibliotheca Kabbalistica, comprising Latin translations of some of the key works of Kabbalah, including the Bahir. This immense enterprise, which must have taken many years to complete, was never published. So it is hard to measure how widely the texts may have circulated, to whom might Pico have lent them. The manuscripts passed into the possession of the Vatican Library, but are now being published under the editorship of Professor Giulio Busi of the Freie Universität Berlin. Pico inspired other Christian thinkers with an enthusiasm for the Kabbalah. He founded a movement, now commonly called Christian Kabbalah, which has survived under various guises down to the present day. The most important of the early Christian Kabbalists was Pico's younger contemporary, Johannes Reuchlin, the greatest humanist scholar of his day. Reuchlin, a fine Hebraist, who could himself read the Kabbalah in the original, as could other Christian Hebraists of the time, published his most mature reflections on the Kabbalah in 1517 in his influential De Arte Kabbalistica. There was a polemical edge to Reuchlin's interest in the Kabbalah in that he believed it contained the true, original theology of Judaism, as opposed to the legalism of the Talmud, though he famously defended the Talmud against Johannes Pfefferkorn. He argued that the Zohar and other Kabbalistic texts confirmed the truth of Christianity, which the Jews had concealed or denied. He was not completely imagining this Christian component in the Kabbalah. Modern scholarship has detected Christian influence on the Zohar. But what Reuchlin failed to grasp was that the elements on which he focused had been borrowed from Christianity and were not independent witnesses to its truth. Both Reuchlin and Pico believed there were profound truths in the Kabbalah, truths that the world needed to know. Though they were deeply interested in Jewish mysticism, neither could meaningfully be called a mystic, and it would be a little odd to find them treated in histories of mysticism. They were interested in both the contemplative and the practical traditions of Jewish mysticism, though more in the former than the latter. But they reduced both, in effect, to propositions which they believed contained ancient wisdom of great value for the renewal and progress of human thought beyond the arid scholasticism of the Middle Ages. They and their followers injected into European thought a massive dose of Kabbalah, sometimes garbled, but nonetheless clearly Kabbalistic, which influenced Christian hermetic movements such as Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, and the Golden Dawn. I have the impression, though there's a lot of work needs to be done on this, that Christian Kabbalism eventually played back in various ways into the mystical tradition. On the Christian side, for example, in the thinking of someone like Jacob Boehme, or on the Jewish side, in the thinking of late Kabbalists, such as the Polish scholar Nathan Netta Shapira. But, as I say, work has to still to be done on this, since the possibility of the intermingling of Jewish and Christian mystical traditions is so seldom pursued in the histories of mysticism in modernity. There is much more I could say, but my time is more than up. I hope I have said enough to have made at least a prima facie case that we may need to refocus our understanding of the Western mystical tradition. As far as our present knowledge goes, its headwaters seem to lie in priestly liturgical practice of Second Temple Judaism, though in both the Christian and the Jewish tradition, well downstream from its source, Platonism made a significant contribution. The importance of liturgy in both traditions needs to be acknowledged, as the locus where on a daily basis, so to speak, mystical states of consciousness were induced, and stress has to be taken off the great mystical writers who were often only wrapping conceptual universes round liturgical praxis. Above all, we need to see the Jewish and Christian mystical traditions together. Having arisen in the same fountainhead, they have continued to interact down through the centuries to the present day. In some cases, we may be dealing with direct borrowing, but in others, we may have each... But in others, we may have each tradition exploiting similar hermeneutics to develop the same primal ideas in similar or contrasting ways. Even in the latter case, heuristic comparison of the two traditions provides a powerful analytical and diagnostic tool and is therefore well worth pursuing. We don't have to think just simply in terms of borrowings and influences. We can read the two traditions side by side heuristically. We need to see the two traditions together and write their histories together. In the area of mysticism, as in other areas, though the ways did part, Judaism and Christianity have remained in a continual dialectic down to the present day, and the contact has not always been polemical or negative. Thank you.